Stop. Good time, good time.
This is Diane Goodman-Larson, and if you want to find me with regard to Mars and time travel, you can go to www.doortoatlantis.com, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Highway run to the
Listen to W Paranormal Talk Radio Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Pioneer Radio Network. For show information, visit WParanormal.com.
Ghost Hunting, my ethereal anti-drug.
This is Pat Fitzhugh of the Bellwitch website, www.bellwitch.org, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
You're all going to die down here.
So, if I was to die in the woods, you would never find me. You'd never find me. I mean, most likely, I mean, chances are, if I was, like, walking through the woods one day, and I just keeled over and died, some squirrel or whatever would just, you know, I mean, they just take over my body and just...
Right. Well, that's natural science. I mean, that just happens.
You have a family that would look for you, hopefully.
Well, that's true. For humans, we have a social structure.
Yeah. Dental records. And the other thing is humans smell bad. Animals don't like to eat us that much.
Really?
Yeah. We have a different kind of smell, and we're not that attractive to because we're so aggressive. I mean, we always think we're peaceful, but a lot of animals just don't like us. So... that's why you'll hear 10 years later that somebody's body was found under a snow pile and, you know, and those kinds of things were under brush because we do have skulls and teeth that really last pretty long.
Well, one thing that's also neglected that people don't think about also is that when an animal, hunter animals, predator types, and this goes back from what I've read all the way back to prehistoric times, is that an animal might see another animal and go, I could eat that. I want to eat that. But that animal might look at that, and that's a very aggressive animal. Now, I could probably overtake that animal, but I might get hurt doing it, though. I could hurt myself doing that. Is it worth it right now? No, I'm not going to do that. So that might be the same thing that applies in this situation where, I mean, we hear stories from all the way from bears eating people, from these giant anaconda-type snakes sucking people down, too. But as far as, like, I mean, I don't know if we want to call it a mentality of animals, because, I mean, as far as, well, I mean, it's coming from a layman right here. They're not nearly as smart as we are. But you're saying...
but they've got a built-in sense.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Survival. It's all
yeah,
it really is.
This is survival here.
I never heard that it put that way, though, where they don't... animals, you know,
don't
other, besides us...
like us. Yeah.
They don't like us. We stink.
Yeah.
I think that if the analysis of the mountain lion killings out west really have been of hikers that are... hikers and people that are actually jogging now in along new trails that are near... old habitat of some of these, and they actually are seeing these people running or walking as deer and not as humans. And so that natural instinct for them to want to attack and eat the deer oftentimes is there, and it's not so much about attacking humans, but here's a creature running. They're running sort of like a deer would, and we call it a jog, and they jump on them. That and older animals that have lost teeth or can't hunt as well are really the two kinds of aggressive animals. I think for Bigfoot, though, where you have a whole complex situation going on, the real breakdown, I mean, it is interesting in the East. for all of these cryptids, these strange creatures that people, you know, tend to call monsters or creatures, a lot of the reports from the East you'll find are from people in trailers. And if I've always thought as trailers and people that are living in the trailers is really at the edges of the new frontier. You know, you have cities that have zoning laws and they don't like trailers and they don't like mobile homes.
Uh-huh.
So those are just a little bit further out than the nice houses and then the even the littler houses in suburbia. And you go a little bit further out and what's really between the frontier and the wild, it's trailers. These people with a very thin piece of metal, of course there's more complex stuff now, but this thin piece of metal that tends to be an organone, you know, a container,
mm-hmm.
and you have Bigfoot reports, you have Thunderbird reports, you have mountain lion reports, and I've gone all over Ohio, all over, you know, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, interviewing people. I come out to their house and find that they live in a trailer. So they're almost like the new frontier as far as those adventurers that are right there at the limits of where the wildness begins.
Mm-hmm.
For these animals, and it is intriguing to me that over and over again, it's the people in the trailers that are seeing things. And I know there's all these jokes about, you know, those people that live in trailers and stuff like that, but over and above that, we really have to consider that there's something to be said, at least in the East, for that's where we'll get the reports of the more wild creatures.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are aware of the jokes, too, unfortunately.
But yeah, but it makes sense.
It does make a lot of sense.
Because you're not going to put your beautiful $190,000 to $290,000 housing, you know, per house housing development,
mm-hmm.
You know, out in Nowhereville where everyone would have to drive forever to get to work.
Exactly.
That would be.
You want to put it where the action's at.
Where the action's at are near expressways and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the folks actually, like, on the edge of the wildness.
Mm-hmm.
Would be in the more affordable housing. So
what's the chances of, let's say, somebody finds remains which they think are human remains, like, because there's, like, obviously, like, not all the bones are there, and they just pass it off as human remains? Because doesn't the Bigfoot kind of is similar to the human? I know they couldn't swing it with the feet because the feet are, well, I don't know, some human.
No, the whole body would be bigger. The whole body, the head, everything, as opposed to. Most humans are really between five and 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, if you get, you know, the remains of a child, you're looking even smaller. So if you come across a Bigfoot that's in the range of 7.5 to 9 feet tall, I think people would probably, you know, maybe not the initial finders, the first responders, so to speak, would. They'd look at this and they'd say, my gosh, that head, you know, is the size of a basketball. That can't be a normal human. And then at that level, then you'll have people saying, you know, what's going on here, and would analyze it. But I think the whole idea that they're dying further out, and that they may be where there's one Bigfoot, there's other Bigfoot, and we know that there's lots of reports of Bigfoot coming through areas seem to be juvenile males. And juvenile males tend to go in little juvenile male groups, just like we see with humans. You know, all the boys are together, all the girls are together.
Mm-hmm.
We hear and see the juvenile males who are probably out exploring and trying to expand territory. And when we hear about families, it's usually, you know, a female Bigfoot and a younger one, or a family group upwards of 2 to 4. And so if we understand that these aren't just one Bigfoot here and then there's no others around, we have to realize that if they're dying, and the older ones would obviously die more probably, and they would probably deal with the body. They'd pull it into a cave, or they'd put it under some brush, or they'd, you know, carry it as far as they could back up into the hills. And so I'm not really convinced that we'll find that many Bigfoot skulls or bodies.
How groundbreaking was, because what this all reminds me of is Jane Goodall decided that someone needed to go study the Society of Apes, right?
Right.
And at that time, because now we're talking a long time ago, right? At that time...
Yeah, way back in the 60s.
Yeah, way back in the 60s. it was like unheard of. It was I remember it being like, oh my gosh, what why? You know, what's she doing out there? But she went out there and she did a lot of hard work. Well, first she had to find them.
Mm-hmm.
Then she had to she spent like decades at this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And had to find them and then had to get them used to her so that she could study their daily habits and things like that. But it's really interesting because there's a slight similarity there in that, you know, she was willing to take that because nobody was going to do it.
No.
I mean, you could go in and hunt down an ape or whatever. Well, it took a long time, but, you know, but it was to study them, that kind of thing, that's like cryptozoology. It's like taking a risk, I would think.
Right. Well, you know, what happened was Richard Leakey was finding all of these fossil apes, and he got a collection of women around him, young women, students, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, and some other women who, and he said, you know, go out. If we need to know about primitive man and prehistoric man by studying the apes. And, you know, Diane Fossey did it with the gorilla. Jane Goodall did it with the chimpanzee.
Oh, chimpanzee.
And how they did it was they went and they stayed motionless in one place for 6 months. They, you know, they got to the camp. They got to know the locals. They didn't move around. They didn't go out and search. They waited for the chimpanzees to come to them or the gorillas to come to them. And also we have to look at this. Most people that are hunting Bigfoot are males. They're males who are weekend warriors, people that go out and spend not much more than 4 days on average,
mm-hmm.
maybe 2 to 4 days looking for Bigfoot. They come back, you know, they sort of beat their chest and said, I went out looking for Bigfoot and I didn't find anything. Surprise, surprise.
But I still have to give them credit for trying.
But,
I mean,
yes, but if we want to really find Bigfoot, we will need to encourage women because these animals are picking up on the pheromones, the aggressive pheromones that are in males, and what happened. And we should look at the model that you just brought up, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, all of these women who went out and were able to interact with gorillas and chimpanzees, orangutans, and all of these animals, including down to monkeys. It's been women who have been there, you know, at the pinnacle of research and exploration. And one of the reasons in Cryptozoology A to Z that I put all of the women that I could find that have been involved in and interested in cryptozoology is that we've got to really understand this is not just about males. This is not just about males. It really needs all kinds of scientists, you know, as far as gender. The other thing that I don't know if you've seen my book, Bigfoot, but my book, there's been obviously hundreds of books written about Bigfoot, but my book, Bigfoot, has a chapter in it called Sex and the Single Sasquatch, because I have seen what has happened with Bigfoot research. It's become so over-identified by humans as if we're talking about large human beings with hair on them that we've forgotten that we're talking about an animal. So I very openly talk about why aren't people in their Bigfoot books talking about the sexual activity of Bigfoot, the breeding, the breasts, the penis, different things like that, that if we were talking about chimpanzees or the pygmy chimpanzee, the bonomo, or the gorilla and orangutans, we would be talking about their sexual activity, their mating, their reproduction, the biology of these animals. But if you read any book about Bigfoot except for mine, which came out last year, I really wanted to break a taboo, which is we've got to talk about these as animals, and we've got to talk about them as live animals, that there's not just one of them, and if there's more than one mm-hmm. of them, they've got to breed. And why aren't people talking about that? So I went through all of the hundreds of years of reports and gleaned from that, you know, the few cases where people have talked about the sexual activity of Bigfoot. And it's there. It's there. There's some really incredible stories. And I you know, depending upon what the age of your listeners are, I'll go into that because I think that, you know, some people are still, I've been, you know, essentially seen as almost too controversial in this area because I'm open to talking about it with families and children and, you know, adults and women and men, because they think we're talking to biology, we're talking zoology. I'm not talking about human beings.
Well, Laura, we love to talk about sex on this show.
We do that quite
so,
often.
So, you know what?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting, one of the best stories about a Bigfoot was a long-term observation of a Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. A geology professor had a small cabin up in the woods in Pennsylvania, and this happened during the 60s, and he wrote down his in-depth observations. He would talk about the Bigfoot coming close to him and, you know, coming into camp and him throwing apples. It's very much like a Jane Goodall situation, because he just was at his cabin. He said every time he brought his camera out or he had a gun or, you know, pieces of metal, this animal, this Bigfoot, would go away. And he saw that there was some aversion to metal. And that's kind of interesting, because most of the old cameras, of course, were metal-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe people really were truthful when they said these things seem to disappear when I got my camera out.
Mm-hmm.
We also know they avoid guns, and they might be smelling the gun oil, but they also could be smelling metal. Anyway, as it went on, he said that he saw these creatures, this one creature, come more and more close and would get the apples and then go away. One day, he said he was out, he had to go fetch water over a hill, and he came back into camp, and he said that the Bigfoot came into near his cabin in his camp, and he said it had a huge erection, and he just couldn't understand what was going on. And he said he felt, and here's a professor talking in his journal, here I felt this embarrassment. I'm looking at this animal, but because of my over-identification with him, I started to get embarrassed because this creature had an erection.
Mm-hmm.
So I shooed him away. And he said, then he went to go get some more water, and he came over a hill, and he was hearing a cow moo, and all of a sudden he saw this Bigfoot, and it was on the back of the cow, mounting the cow, having sex with the cow. And, you know, that's not a kind of report you read in a regular Bigfoot book.
I would not imagine so.
No.
And finally the Bigfoot came back into camp, and he said the penis wasn't erect anymore, but it was dripping, and so he felt really embarrassed even more. And he yelled at it, and he started leaving for his car. And he said as he left, he yelled at it. He said, you know, and she wasn't even that good looking.
So
he had a sense of humor about it, but it's a remarkable story, because you just don't hear that much about Bigfoot and, you know, the male anatomy of a Bigfoot. You hear about some of them, of course, defecating in the woods, but you don't hear that much about people seeing it. There's one report from the west of a man who came over a ridge up in Oregon, and he was noticing, was looking through his binoculars, and he saw two female Bigfoot, rather young, and one was fooling with her vaginal area quite a bit, and he said she was moaning and, you know, in somewhat an enjoyable mood. And you just, that's another report, is one of few that you hear about, perhaps. And we know this from chimpanzees, they masturbate all the time. And so we have this report of one good report of probably a female masturbating and being seen by a person that was interested in Bigfoot. He wasn't necessarily out there to find this, but he did find it. So you really have to look very hard, and I decided to bring all of these together in one chapter, because we need to start looking at these stories and being open to them and not being so, you know, puritanic that we can't talk about the sex. You know, we know that they have breasts, and of course, because it's a male-dominated field, people will often talk about Bigfoot and the Bigfoot breasts on the Patterson film and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Male anatomy is much more taboo.
Well, it is incredible. I mean,
that's not scientific.
You're gonna snicker a little bit, of course, but I mean, it makes a lot of sense to talk about that, though. And it's the first time I've ever heard anybody talk about Bigfoot as far as mating ritual would go, or some type of thing like that. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that's part of it's part of the puzzle.
And you have to remember, you can't apply human values to this animal. this animal is going, you know, although it's more intelligent than say a slug, mm-hmm. but it's got instincts and things like that, and it's acting on instincts. I mean, it's got a society structure, presumably, but not, you know, not like rules and morals and you know, and religion. So so you can't apply the, you know, what we've learned as humans over the eons to this particular species of animal.
No,
you can't, but people do. I gave that same, you know, longer, not much longer, but the hour long conference, and gave a little talk about this Pennsylvania story, and I got back home, and the internet was filled full of these reports that Lauren Coleman tells Ohio conference that Bigfoot is gay.
Oh, oh my God.
And it just blew my mind, because, and then one funny guy wrote in and said, well, if Lauren said that Bigfoot was gay, then why was it doing that to a, you know, that he would have been doing, the Bigfoot would have been doing that to a bull and not a cow. So, you know, people were having fun with it, and fun at my expense, but that's fine, because I at least had people starting to talk about it, and it's been behind a closet, you know, and obviously Bigfoot, I don't know what the sexual preference is of Bigfoot, but I have not heard of any.
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about before, though, that you can't apply human morals to
exactly.
this. You can't do that, and I agree 100%, because firsthand I can tell you, when I lived with my friend Jim, he had two dogs, a German Shepherd and a Chow. And they're both males. They're both little boys, and they weren't snipped, okay? They're both little boys, and I used to get a kick. This is going to really knock my credibility way up. But I used to get a major kick out of it, because, I mean, I used to laugh at it, because these dogs, I'd sit there and play with them, going back and forth, throwing the rope around, and if the Chow saw that the German Shepherd wasn't paying attention, he'd grab him and try to mount him.
Of course, yeah.
And we joking aside, I mean, you can't apply a human moral to that. Of course, we do. But you can't. They don't understand the same things that we do.
Right. They don't have the religion. They don't have the society, you know, that we have. So
right.
Very interesting.
Another myth that I tried to get rid of in the book is that there's this whole old tale, old Bigfoot tale, supposedly, that Bigfoot are out there kidnapping Indian natives and taking them back to their caves.
Really?
Well, once again, I did an analysis of all the reports and found that most of the reports are of Bigfoot being reported to capture and kidnap males and taking them back to their family groups. And if you start looking at it and thinking about it, if you have a Bigfoot population that is short on genetic material, and you have an aggressive male Bigfoot that's looking for, you know, a father that's looking for a mate for his daughter, perhaps some of the, and it is interesting, a lot of the reports are of males who had heavy clothing on, such as even, you know, long underwear underneath their coat and their clothes. And I wondered if perhaps these Bigfoot were confusing human males as another, you know, variety of Bigfoot, and they wanted to bring it back and have it mate with their daughters to try to extend the breed. So
that'd be a hell of a way to ruin your weekend right there.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Walking through the woods, minding your own business, and all of a sudden a Bigfoot grabs you and takes you back and goes, okay.
Here she is.
This
is your new bride. Yes. Yikes.
I mean, judging by the size of this thing, what more can you really say? Okay, all right, I guess I'll do this.
You wouldn't argue with Father Bigfoot, though.
I wouldn't.
You'd be like, okay. Well.
The Albert Osmond story is where he was actually captured and taken to a canyon in British Columbia and kept there for about, you know, 4 days or so before he figured out that they like to smell his snuff, and so he filled some coffee grounds and snuff together and rolled it over to the older male. There was a group, older male, older female, young male, and a breeding age female.
Mm-hmm.
And he said she kept looking at him from behind the bushes in a very friendly way. And it was the only Bigfoot that he did not want to describe in depth to Ivan Sanders and some other people that investigate it. He would talk about the males, he'd talk about the older female, but he never really wanted to talk too much about the young female, and that was quite interesting. Anyway, he threw this coffee grounds and stuff over, and the old male who was really guarding him more got all sick and started coughing and vomiting and stuff, and so he was able to escape from this and told the story, and this happened in 1924.
Wow. That long ago.
Was there ever, because we have a listener in the United Kingdom who wonders if perhaps, you know, how the stories were that males were reportedly captured and taken back to the cave. Was there ever any evidence of the other way around where
the female,
the Bigfoot decided he was really aggressive and strong and wanted a human female?
Well, there have been, you know, they're infrequent, but Native Canadians, especially in British Columbia and a little bit further up, have reported occasional kidnappings of female Indians and taken back. And even there's one or two really strange reports of Indian babies being born that were supposedly half Sasquatch.
Ooh.
But they seem almost to be more 350-year-old folklore tales.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Most of the male kidnapping reports are from 1924 on, and we have much better evidence of them.
Interesting. So, you know, one of the things that I look forward to every year, and I didn't get to see it last year for some reason, but Lauren Coleman writes the top cryptozoological stories of the previous year. And you've done this for several years in a row, and for some reason I must have missed.
No, I didn't do it. It became quite a complex thing to do, and I was thinking maybe this year I'll do 2003 and 2004.
Well, I look forward to that every year, because you started, what, about 4 years ago or so doing that?
Yeah, I made a list of 10-year predictions, and then I also did the list of the top stories. And what I noticed is after I started doing it, then last year there was an explosion of copycats. There was somebody that did a list of the top 10 Bigfoot stories. There was somebody that did a list of a top 10 paranormal stories in which they even mentioned me twice in there. And you know,
cool.
So all of a sudden there was these top 10 or 20 lists, of crypto zoo stories. And so I felt like, well, maybe but I have been thinking, yeah, that I should do it because it was, you know, and maybe even not waiting. I oftentimes would wait until after the end of the year because I wanted to really give the whole year a possibility, but maybe I'll do it around the 15th of this year because it seems like all of them get published before the end of the year, even though the year's not over.
Right. And, well, what I like about your versions was that you have such a grasp over the entire, you know, because you've been doing this for 44, 45 years. You've got a grasp over the entire situation going on with cryptozoology,
right?
And you don't discriminate. I mean, because you're like this. You're not like my favorite thing is Bigfoot, or my favorite thing is cats, or my favorite thing is
a new crocodile in Somalia, or you know, different places.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, there was a little controversy about that list this summer because the Russian Pravda published a list of the top cryptozoological stories, and they actually stole my list from 2000.
Oh, God.
Published it as new stories. You know, they left out the dates quite cleverly, and so I wrote them, and by the end of the day, or couple days, because I guess other people got upset because they could tell that it was my stuff, they put at the end of the story a link to my website without admitting what they'd done.
Oh,
you know?
Nice.
So it's been quite funny to see that list float all over.
Well, that's the miracle of modern communication.
Yes.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. We've been talking about Bigfoot for a solid hour here.
And another thing that I know that you're very interested in is Mothman. And that's really interesting because we had gone to the Mothman Festival this past year, third annual Mothman Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to learn a lot about the Mothman and
uh-huh.
what was done. And you know what puzzles me? The Mothman, as far as I know, was, you know, for a brief moment in time, if you look at, you know, planetary age, it was like only a year and a half, or a year and 8 months or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one creature, right? Why is that cryptozoological then? Why does that attract your interest? Because it's not like like we're talking about Bigfoot with societies of Bigfoot and things like that. It was a very interesting story. It's a very scary story as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But it attracts your interest. How come?
Well, because you've given the story that the movies and the media would like us all to believe, but the reality is much more complex. For one thing, and there's a new book out called Thunderbirds, America's Living Legends of Giant Birds by Mark A. Hall that I wrote the introduction to. And he has a whole section there in there about what he calls Big Hoot or Mothman. There's reports from that same area of West Virginia and Ohio that go back to the 1920s of these large owls, giant owls, chasing cars down the road. There's reports from the 1960s before that period that we all know about. And the Mothman, the modern Mothman, started with the sighting on November 15th, 1966. And supposedly everybody thinks they all stopped on December 15th, and we're getting very close to that anniversary, December 15th, 1967, when the Silver Bridge collapsed. And everybody, you know, the whole Mothman Prophecies, a title that was really thought up by the publisher, not by John Keel,
yes,
is that this creature was seen, one creature, and that then the bridge collapsed. Well, the truth behind the Mothman is that all of the local people called it Big Bird because they were saying that this was a big bird or more than one big bird, and there are multiple big birds or Mothman being seen. And then the story got picked up over in Ohio. There were some sightings over in Ohio. There were some sightings in Mississippi all around the same time of these thunderbird or these giant owls. And over in Ohio, a copy editor who was a great fan of the Batman series on TV liked the whole notion of adding the word man to an animal like bat.
Uh-huh.
And so he came up with the word Mothman.
Uh-huh.
Nobody ever said it looked like a moth. In fact, Linda Scarborough, who you might have met down there in Point Pleasant and I interviewed, she said that when she first saw it, she thought about a bird later, but when she first saw it, she thought of an angel because she said this thing had these wings behind its body and it was standing on the ground and then it started flying away and she thought of an angel, but she quickly changed to a bird. The next night when it was seen by several, other people, the Thomases and the Bennett and all of those individuals, they called it a big bird too. And it kept being called a big bird by the sheriff's department, by the police, by eyewitnesses. Over 200 people saw it during those few months, those 13 months that really it was, 13. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as soon as Mothman came into being because of the headline, then it just overwhelmed the whole area, and it was called a Mothman. But it has nothing to do with one creature. It has nothing to do with really the paranormal. It was just a mundane, normal cryptozoological case that because of the publicity and the use of one title, it really has changed it into something more. And of course, John Keel's book, which all of these reports that got so much publicity was really in the 60s, his book did not come out until 1975. And he, John Keel, I don't know if you know him, I know him really well, and he's more or less, he said, I'm not a ufologist, I'm a demonologist. He views everything through a very occult, dark, demonological viewfinders.
Mm.
And so he was having experiences back up in New York with contactees and people speaking to him and strange phone calls and men in black and UFOs. And so in his book, it's almost like he's thrown all of these things into a blender. And I really see them as much more separate incidents. There were Men in Black reports, perhaps, and there were all of these other things going on. In addition, there were these Big Bird reports, and they just got pulled into it by John Keel to make a story. And he was a very good writer. He was a TV sitcom writer. He was a newspaper man. He had lots of writing skills that go into almost the American novel of the paranormal. And you can see it in the movie, Richard Gere movie.
Well, that explains the red eyes then, huh? I mean, as far as a demonology point of view, that's what I was going to ask
you.
Oh,
yeah, like, the red eyes. The red eyes, the people that saw it, the eyewitnesses, you can see it in the original reports, and I talked to them about it. It's only, the red eyes only showed up whenever the headlights of the cars was shining into it.
Okay.
They weren't self-illuminating. They weren't, there was nothing ghost-like or paranormal about it. These were just animals that were being, you know, highlighted with the headlights.
Oh, man. Well, here's, I really want to talk about this for a second, too.
Okay.
Because the Mothman is fascinating, but I'm a reptile buff. I'm a huge reptile buff. That's my favorite thing. As far as your list is concerned, can you throw out a couple, maybe just a couple quick ones as far as the reptile side of things go, as far as cryptozoology goes? Like you mentioned something about a giant crocodile, so to say, a few seconds ago. What do you have a couple ones that you've come across in the years that stick out, possibly?
Well, I think we can go two ways with this. There's lots of, you know, there's a coelacanth, which was a living fossil, which is a fish,
mm-hmm.
and then there's, of course, been, you know, discoveries. In my list, I always would talk about the recovery or new discovery of crocodiles. And the monitor lizards, for instance, are very interesting. There's the whole tales of the Buru. In 1951, the Daily Mail of London mounted a whole expedition to find in Aswan, which is near the Himalayas, and in Burma and different places like that, there were reports of this creature called the Buru, and it was a gigantic, it's almost very much larger than a Komodo dragon, an aquatic lizard, probably a huge monitor lizard that existed there. The people on the expedition felt that the natives were talking about an animal that had gone extinct. But what we do know is in New Guinea, there's probably a giant monitor lizard that still lives there. There's reports from the interior of Australia of these creatures. So there seems to be some of those around.
Well, I know a Komodo dragon, generally a Komodo dragon, they tend to be about 10 to 12 foot, if I'm correct.
These are about 15 feet. And
Jesus.
Some of them are saying they're even 20 feet long.
Dude.
That's one thing. Then there's this whole other, and this kind of goes much more over into the paranormal, or, you know, how people talk about the reptoids and, you know, the people that are really reptilian and stuff like that.
Reptilian,
well, there's reports from the Ohio River Valley on up into New York State, somewhat up into some other states, of what I call the creatures of the Black Lagoon. And these are creatures that almost look like that classic gill man. And there was reports of two police officers seeing a frog man in Loveland, Ohio. There's reports of people seeing these creatures with spikes on their head, with, you know, almost like feet that looked more like fins than like feet. There's very few of these reports, but in my book about, which is called Mothman and Other Curious Encounters, I talk about these reports. I really don't come to any conclusion about them other than to try to gather them all in one place, because down through the years, people have said they've had these real experiences with these giant frogs or giant lizards. And it's interesting. I just think it's interesting in terms of, is there anything? Is there any fire beneath this smoke? Which is really much different than my annual reports about new discoveries of reptiles and other animals like that.
Well, there's a lot more reports or evidence on, so say, someone like, well, on a creature like Nessie, though. Nessie, I mean, they've been studying her since the better part of the early part of the century.
You know, speaking of Nessie, we might want to ask Lauren Coleman for a quick preview. I know that on this week's Proof Positive, which is a new show on the Sci-Fi Channel, they're going to be talking about Ogopogo, which is related to, well, it's a similar story to Nessie. So if we're going to do that, if we're going to talk about Nessie, which is another thing that fascinates me, I wonder what your take on Ogopogo is.
Well, I've been out there too and interviewed those people and talked to them, and Ogopogo. I wrote a book called The Field Guide to Lake Monsters, and in that I looked at all these reports. I think Ogopogo actually has some pretty substantial background to it. We have Champ in Lake Champlain. These creatures tend to be long and slender sometimes. What's intriguing about Ogopogo, a creature that is about 20 feet long, seems to have humps, seems to have a head that looks like a horse. It looks quite like what's called caddy out in the bay off of off the coast of British Columbia. So I'm not saying they're related, but as far as in that area, British Columbia and the lakes in British Columbia, you have a consistent report of a many-humped creature with a head like a horse. And more than just like a horse, it has a mane, it has whiskers, it has eyebrows, and as far as Nessie, there are more than one Nessies, of course, so the Loch Ness monsters. Here again, if you're British and a cryptozoologist, you'll probably come down on the side that Nessie is a plesiosaurus, that it's a reptile, a prehistoric reptile that's some way lived in this landlocked lake through many ice ages and all of that. If you're an American or some of the continental cryptozoologists, we tend to think that Nessie is probably an ancient whale or an unknown species of seal. Because if you look closely at the reports of Nessie, of Ogopogo, of Lake Champlain's Champ, you'll see that they're oftentimes reported to be covered with hair, to have these long manes made of hair, they have eyelashes, they have a movement. Reptiles in the water, and if you're a reptile man, you know this, they move side to side.
Yep.
A whale and all kinds of mammals, seals, move up and down through the water.
Mm-hmm.
Very distinctive difference that is often overlooked in these reports. So I'm of the school that if there is a lake monsters in these lakes, and if there's a loch monster in Scotland, that they're mammals. They're an unknown mammal. The other thing that is often overlooked with Nessie is that there's over 40 reports of the Loch Ness monsters being seen on land, seen crossing roads.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. There have been a couple of cases, actually, where people will be, like, driving in their car.
Right.
And they look in their rear view, and all of a sudden they see something, like, flopping across the road.
Right.
Like a giant sea elephant or a giant walrus. And there are new reports that some of the sonic, as opposed to the sonar, but the sonic recordings of these creatures under Loch Ness, that they sound like a walrus. And so that's very, very interesting to us, because these land sightings seem like they're talking about more like a sea elephant or a walrus. And if they're, you know, it's only a mile between the ocean and the end of Loch Ness, so we might have some migration going on. We could have some of these giant seals coming into Loch Ness to breed. There's all kinds of possibilities that if you get into only one theory, that they're a plesiosaurus, well, plesiosaurus would have to be warm-blooded, they'd have to give live birth, and they'd have to be able to eat very few salmon, because there aren't that many salmon in Loch Ness. But if you look at the mammals and think about, well, maybe they're a mammal, which we know are warm-blooded, we know they'd give live birth, and they can cross land to get to the ocean. Maybe it's not animals that are in Loch Ness all the time, but maybe they come back and forth.
They vacation.
Opened up a lot of possibilities.
Well, here in Michigan, because we've got obviously the Great Lakes, right?
Mm-hmm. You've got Bessie in Lake
Erie. We have Bessie in Lake Erie. We also have Mishipishwe.
Uh-huh.
Mishipishwe is a large serpent that evidently goes up and down the St. Clair River.
Okay.
Right? And looks like a serpent. It has a serpent head.
Okay.
Very interesting, because that's an ancient, actually, Indian legend. And I don't know if they're related or not, but we do have Bessie, and we've got, that's the more well-known and modern one of Lake Erie, right?
Right. You also have some reports. What's the body of water that's near Detroit? Is it?
That Lake Erie.
Lake Erie, yeah.
Erie, right. There have been reports nearer the Detroit area than Bessie. Bessie tends to be further away than around Detroit.
Right. She's usually seen, I think, in Ohio.
Right.
From the Ohio border.
But I remember from the 50s, there were some reports around Detroit in the waters there of creatures that had fins on their back, almost as if they were sharks or dolphins, which was, you know, much different than what you usually hear about lake monsters. Lake monsters tend to look like overturned boats or, you know, the serpents that you just mentioned. But these creatures were, you know, kind of bizarre that they would have a large fin on their back, because obviously there's not going to be sharks, supposedly, in the, you know, near Detroit.
Right, in the fresh water.
Right.
Not
only tigers and red wings.
Exactly. But they we've got, you know, because of our large bodies of waters, we've got, you know, some of our own, but it's really interesting. I am very interested in seeing what on Wednesday night what Proof Positive comes up with Ogopogo anyway.
Well, the thing you got to think about as far as
Proof Positive tends to set up people to tear them apart. It's a very skeptical show.
It is. I agree in some cases, but the
it's interesting nonetheless.
It's really, I think it's really well done, and I mean, I'm glad that they're doing it. I'm glad that they're out there investigating such a wide variety of phenomena, because now that, you know, sightings has been done for a while, so it's like, you know, what can we watch now? And they came up with Proof Positive, and I'm really happy because Amanda Tapping is a really attractive-looking host, you know.
For cryptozoologists, there's Mystery Encounters, there's Mystery Hunters, there's you know, different shows like that that are pretty routine. I was filmed this summer for Mystery Hunters, which is kind of encouraging because it's for kids. They tend to also be pretty skeptical, which seems to be where the money's going in this country to conservative skeptics. But anyway, that's another topic.
That's a whole other show, yeah.
You look down for that one.
The other really good show that's out of Discovery UK, which is shown over here on cable, is Animal X.
Mm-hmm.
Animal X doesn't take a skeptical point of view. They don't take an overly, you know, pro, but they give the evidence. And Animal X, I think, is in its third season, and it's probably best cryptozoological show.
Well, the thing you got to think about, as we're talking about this, and we're talking about bodies of water, it seems to be the same thing applies to space. I'm talking about outer space, and there's all, you know, theoretically, there's just all this space out there around us, and they always neglect to think about this, though, too, is that on this planet, 70% water, okay? There's a lot of water on this planet, a lot of huge bodies of water, and it's impossible to cover all that as far as, and we're just talking about the surface of the water. Mm-hmm. We haven't even talked about the depth of the water now, too.
Well, even the landlocked Loch Ness, even that, they can't cover that. I mean, I had seen a special where they had taken, you know, several boats and tried to string them along and tried to do one sweep of the entire lock, and it just, I don't think you can cover that. That's even if landlocked and it's a certain amount of water, how could you know what's going on in oceans and in,
exactly.
Yeah, and in these huge bodies of water like...
There's enough water in Loch Ness to cover every person on Earth under 6 feet of water.
Really?
Yes. Loch Ness is 23 miles long, 21, 23 miles, depending on who you'll talk to, and about 700 to 800 feet deep.
Wow.
It is a huge body of water.
So you cannot possibly monitor
it. No, Operation Deep Scan, with their joke that they strung these boats along and they covered the whole lock with sonar and, you know, radar and all of that. It's just it's baloney because, you know, there's caves, there's deep areas of the lock. If there was an animal there, or many animals, even a family group, they could have hid at one end and then raced around. So, or they could have not been there. They could have been on land. So that's a joke, and you're right. There's been some scientific papers that have been written. Charles Paxton wrote a great one in which he said that in the next 25 years, we're going to find 47 new species of animals in the ocean that are over 6 feet long. and that's pretty incredible. I mean, it's just, you know, we're finding a lot of beaked whales all the time because there's probably about 25 species of beaked whales that have been seen but never described scientifically. But I think we're going to find some really startling things. We found the megamouth only in 1976, the megamouth shark, second largest shark in the world. And, you know, it's quite encouraging, I think, to think that there's all of that area that can't be covered and is probably going to have some incredible cryptozoological surprises.
There's a lot of cryptozoology happening down in Brazil as well, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's quite a bit of interest there, of course, for conserving animals that are already there. And during, as you probably know from reading my list, during the last decade, every year of that decade, there was one new species of primate, even though it was a small monkey, that has been discovered. And we're right on the edge of getting some information that there's a new species of jaguar, there's some new large monkeys that are going to be identified, and there's probably one or two new birds, too, as well as reptiles and turtles and different things like that. The other big area, of course, for discoveries is Southeast Asia and Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
This whole business about the Flores man, the skull that was found less than, you know, about 12 to 10,000 years old, and it wasn't a fossil that they found of the Flores people. It was actually unfossilized bones that they said looked like and felt like mashed potatoes, which they had to very carefully dry out and reconstruct. And that was that's a whole race of little people, little hairy people, 3 feet tall, that lived at the same time as Homo sapiens. And that is just, I think that's as big a discovery as the coelacanth, the living fossil, or the gorilla, or the okapi. And in the coming years, these little people and scientists and anthropologists will wake up to the feeling and notion that we've got to look around for Yeti, we've got to look around for Bigfoot, because more than just humans have lived here at the same time as these creatures.
What, being Lauren Coleman, do you get to see these things? Like, did you actually get to see is it pronounced coelacanth? And do you think you'll be invited to see one of these tiny skulls that they found?
Well, I have downstairs in my home museum one of the only two reproductions of the coelacanth, life-size coelacanth in the world. This is a six-foot-long thing that's on my wall of a living fossil. I've seen giant squid in museums. I've seen coelacanth.
You've seen a giant squid?
Yeah. I wrote an article in 1980 for the magazine Boston about the giant squid that was found down off the coast of Massachusetts, and went and examined it with the scientists at the museum. So they're quite big.
How big was that one?
That one was, I think that was in the range of nearly 20 feet long with the tentacles.
Wow.
Yeah, that you read my mind, Lauren, because I wanted to just get something from you on that, because I find squids fascinating.
Giant squids, and I think there are giant octopus, and we're getting closer and closer to analyzing some of those old samples from that 1896 giant octopus that was found on the coast there at Fort Augustine, St. Augustine, Florida. So, you know, there are things out there. There's some things in museums, and that's where some of the rediscoveries, the Congo peacock was rediscovered in a museum, and I think there's probably some things that are sitting on shelves right now that we just need to open our minds and reanalyze, and we'll discover some new animals as well as finding them out in the field.
Fascinating. This hour and a half has gone by so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
but we only have 1 minute left, so I want to tell everybody, Lauren Coleman, your website, of course, is laurencoleman.com.
Right, with the Midwestern spelling of Lauren.
Yes.
Yeah.
Midwestern, L-O-R-E-N. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's linked up on our site, ghostlytalk.com.
Permanently.
And you've got, you're always obviously writing books and going
articles
out and about doing stuff. So so basically, I guess folks would go to your website to see what you're doing next and what
you're
releasing.
That's a good place to look, and it has usually my most current books. And in Maine, actually, we're planning with a college here, International Cryptozoological Symposium, next to Halloween.
Really?
So we'll have people from all over the world flying in. That should be... Plus, it's going to be an exhibit called Cryptozoology and Art, so it could be quite exciting.
Oh, wow. Now, Halloween is a ghostly kind of year, or time of year, so I don't
Let's
know.
Let's change it.
I know, I'm going to have to flip a coin again and see what I'm going to do. But you guys, we have to fly because we have to make way for W Paranormal that comes up next. Mm-hmm. Lauren, can you hang on for a moment?
Sure. It was great being here, folks.
It was an honor
having you on, sir.
Absolute honor, and I've learned so much, and I do every year. I'm looking forward to, if you get around to doing the top tens again, I'd love that. I missed it last year. So thank you very much.
Hang on the line for one second.
Hang on the line. I just want to close out the show and make way for W Paranormal coming up next here on Pioneer.
Yeah.
Remember, Pioneer is pioneer.rolo.net, R-O-L-O.net. Mm-hmm. And, of course, our website is www.ghostlytalk.com. Everything's linked up on there. Mm-hmm. We're going to have this show available for download.
About an hour and a half.
Yep. Very soon. And folks will be able to share this show with other folks interested in Bigfoot and cryptozoology. Of course, go to Amazon.com, type in Lauren Coleman, LaurenColeman. You'll get books.
Lots
of it'll books. Yeah, the end of the year, you're just going to give out Lauren Coleman books for Christmas to everybody. that's what I'm going to do. So you guys, thanks very much.
Yeah.
This has been Ghostly Talk. I'm Doug.
I'm Scott L.
And I'm Karma.
And thanks, Lauren Coleman, and we will see you all next week, same time.